Low profits and tight cash flows hit Midwestern farmers hard in recent years. 2017 looks like more of the same, but farm lender Bill Watson says they've seen much worse.
A lot of people say, is this the same kind of thing that we were in the 80s? Okay? And my answer to that is clearly no.
Agriculture is a multi-billion dollar business in Illinois. Why farmers here and across the Midwest are taking a big hit and what it means for the state economy. Plus, when parents and coaches scream and yell during kids' games, it can have a lasting impact.
You know, you just kind of leave feeling bad about yourself, just about everything. You know, you're questioning, you know, am I capable of doing this?
What some leagues are doing to change the dynamic on the field and the sidelines. And armadillos are invading Illinois, making their way farther north than we've ever seen before. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. You know, driving through many parts of Illinois right now, the corn growing tall, the soybeans seem strong, but many farmers in the state say they're struggling. It's the fourth straight year Midwest growers face low profits, low prices for some of the most important crops. Illinois is one of the largest agricultural producers in the country. Farmland here makes up about three-quarters of the state's land. Growing and selling crops adds about $20 billion a year to the state economy. Some are comparing this downturn to the farm crisis of the 1980s, or at least a prelude to it. You know, how bad is it, and what's this doing to farmers here and across the Midwest? We'll talk with a northern Illinois farmer here in just a moment. But first, Peggy Lowe has been reporting on this for Harvest Public Media, where she's an editor. That was her tape you heard just before the newscast here this morning. Her story is headlined, Farm Economy Downturn Prompts Fears of a Crisis. Peggy, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Hey, good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me.
You know, one of the people that you talked with is a farmer named Tom Giesel. We have a clip here from your story where he points to one big part of the problem, supply and demand.
There are still piles of grain from last year on the ground, and we're harvesting this year's crop. So what does that tell you about oversupply?
Is that, Peggy, is that oversupply kind of the primary driver here?
That's one of them, certainly. You know, there's low commodity prices, oversupply, a real global grain glut. This is especially hard-pressed for farmers who are producing grain, sorghum, corn, soybeans, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And Tom Giesel, who I talked to in central Kansas, is also a wheat farmer, and he didn't get very good prices. He came in, you know, I think this was like maybe the fourth week of June that he had his harvest finished. So hardest pressed right now are those grain farmers. And yeah, I see those piles of grain around the elevators. For instance, when I drive north out of Kansas City and I go visit my parents in Nebraska City, tons and tons of grains sitting just outside all the elevators.
And that's last year's crop. And we're coming up not too long, a couple months away from a new harvest here. That's, you know, that's not a great sign. How long has this been going on in terms of this the downturn, turn to lower prices, that type of thing?
Well, to be fair here, in 2013, farmers saw record income. It was just a really, really good year for them. Now, since then, 4 years later, it has completely turned around. And in fact, their net farm income has been cut in half. That's a USDA stat. So Tom Giesel, for instance, he's a member of the National Farmers Union. And the reason I started doing this story is I noticed that they had a web page dedicated just to what they are now calling the farm crisis. And one of the things that they have up there is a suicide prevention line. And those of us who can remember the 80s know that was a really bad time for farmers. And so that's why I went out and talked to Tom. Now, not everybody agrees that it's crisis proportions. And I think that's why you wanted to talk to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does bring up, one person you talked to in the story also referred to it as an adjustment. Others like Tom's, well, if it's not a crisis yet, it is pretty darn close. I think people will remember, I mean, the 1980s, farmers losing their land, thousands and equipment, Farm Aid, you know, launched in 1985. I mean, that was a pretty awful moment there. You know, is there a comparison today? What did you hear on that front?
It's certainly not to those levels yet, but it could be if this farm income continues to go low. So, for instance, the lead ag business or ag banker I talked to here in Kansas City said, is it a crisis yet? No. What's concerning, he said, is when farmers begin to not be able to make their payments, whether that's on land or whether that's on machinery or whether that's next year's seed corn. He said, then it's going to get you know, pretty dicey. So, yeah, and as you said, an ag economist at Purdue said it's an adjustment. He and the banker point to this one big fact. The big difference between now and the 80s is the fact that exports are still fine. And the exports dried up in the 80s, and that was one of the things that led to that decade's crisis because of the Soviet Union embargo on grain. Yeah. So right now, exports are fine. That said, farmers are very nervous, of course, because President Trump has said he wants to renegotiate NAFTA and he wants to pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And both of those trade deals have been good for farmers.
Yeah, those are big markets for agriculture. Well, you mentioned earlier sort of the grains as the primary crops here. Let's talk to a farmer now. Brian Duncan, he does grow corn, among other things, raises hogs and things on a family farm up in Ogle County. That's in northern Illinois, just south of the Rockford area. Brian, welcome to the 21st. I appreciate your time.
Hey, Scott. Great to talk to you. Thank you.
So are you feeling this right now? Are you feeling this kind of this financial crunch?
Sure. Yeah, those numbers are real. I mean, these are real numbers that affect real people. And you don't have an income drop of 50% without feeling it. I mean, that's just reality for me as both a grain farmer and a livestock producer.
Yeah, and so how is it affecting you? What is it doing to you and your business? It sounds like you must be facing some tough decisions.
Well, yeah, it's been that way for a couple of years now. I mean, we definitely changed the way we look at buying inputs. Have to generate obviously enough revenue to pay for themselves. And
inputs you're talking about, is that equipment? Is that seed? What do you mean by inputs?
Everything. Okay. But you know, let's talk about especially on crop protection side. You know, some of the products we buy, you know, such as fungicide, need to now at these prices generate added yield of 15 bushel of the acre to pay for themselves, and they just won't do it. So we're cutting input purchases. We're not buying any new machinery. I mean, we're reviewing how we do everything and trying to shave costs, but we can only cut costs so far.
So far, yeah. And I know it's a family farm up there. Do you have other workers, other people? Is there a staff? Have you had to look at any cuts there?
Not yet. As a livestock farmer, we are transitioning and making some changes in our hog operation, and we have not replaced some people that have moved on. So that's one change we're making. I mean, it was you know, the income side on the livestock was particularly devastating, especially on the hog side last fall. So, you know, this is a double whammy. I'm sorry?
So a double or triple whammy. I mean, everything's going down at the same time.
Exactly. You know, usually in a diversified operation, we like to think we've got, you know, one lead item that's being profitable. And, you know, right now, all sectors in agriculture are feeling this.
Well, you heard us talk before about the comparison to the crisis of the 1980s. I mean, how does this feel to you? Does it remind you at all of those moments?
No, not yet, I would say. In the 80s, you had another factor as well. You had sky-high interest rates. So farmers who had leverage, who had borrowed money, were really getting hurt on that end too. So we're not feeling that pain yet. And so far, asset values have held up. Land is still held up. So, you know, our balance sheets, the equity positions, has remained sound for the most part, even though we're experiencing cash operating losses. So what happened in the 80s is you had a massive drop in equity. Land, machinery, everything just fell to the ground.
Yeah, it was almost that perfect storm of, yeah.
Yeah, and couple that with sky high interest rates, it was a 1-2 punch that knocked a lot of guys out.
Well, Peggy Lowe, coming back to you for a moment here, we've heard Brian describe a little bit some of the changes he's looking at. Have you heard things from other farmers about what they're doing to prepare to sort of weather this right now?
Yeah, some, for instance, when I talked to Tom Giesel, he's 64. He said, okay, here's the kind of thing I'm thinking about. He goes, and guys like me are thinking about this too, that, you know, a guy who's a few years from retirement, say, okay, so I've had a few bad years. It's going to take me a few more years to, you know, undig myself if things actually get better. And we don't know if things will actually get better. So why should I carry on? You know, why would I be using my retirement savings to run my operation now? You know, why not just retire and, you know, make the best of it? So I think farmers are being forced right now to make some really, really tough decisions, you know. And as Brian said, too, you know, like on inputs, am I going to use all that herbicide? You know, am I going to buy that new piece of machinery? Probably not. Am I going to try to share machinery with others? That kind of thing. Really tough decisions right now.
And Brian, I mean, you talked about some of those inputs. Are the prices of those stable? Are you seeing those also jump up too while the income's going down?
That's a mixed bag. Input prices have been slow to come down. Fertilizer has come down. Seed remains very stubbornly high. It's to the point we're looking at spending 20% of our gross revenue on corn just to buy the seed. Those kind of figures are just not sustainable. Someone needs to get a message to the seed industry in general that those kind of prices are not sustainable. But land remains stubbornly high. So yeah, it's a mixed bag as far as declining inputs. But fertilizer, fuel, some of those things have come down since the high in 2012-2013.
Yeah, well, the voice there of Brian Duncan, farmer in Ogle County, also talking with Peggy Lowe, Investigations Editor at Harvest Public Media, about the financial hit that many farmers across the Midwest are taking. A huge industry in Illinois, a $20 billion industry across agriculture, so it has a widespread effect here in the state. Peggy Lowe, coming back to you for a minute, what ag banks, farm credit services, things like that, these lenders, are they concerned too? Are you hearing anything from them?
I've had reports that ag lending has dried up to a certain extent. So, yeah, the credit markets are getting tough. The bankers are staying the course. They rely a lot on the idea that all these exports, the sales on the trade deals will help boost everything. What a lot of the advocacy groups and even, say, Congress people out here in farm country are talking about now, they are beginning to write the next farm bill. And as we all know, the Farm Bill, you know, it's every 5 years. So this comes up in 2018. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has said they're going to cut billions from USDA's budget. So how is the next Farm Bill going to affect people? Will there still be a safety net? Will there be crop insurance? Will there be assistance on ag lending? That kind of thing.
And those things were key in Illinois, especially in 20. There was a drought of 2012 that wiped out a lot of crops. And those supports were key to a lot of farmers in Illinois.
Right. And if those are cut by the Trump administration, well, that's really going to hurt some farmers out here.
Yeah. Well, Brian, I'm pulling you in just on the policy side. I mean, you've seen the conversations about, you know, NAFTA, about the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. I mean, exports are a big part of Illinois. I can't speak for your farm, but of Illinois' grain production. How would this, are you watching that, I guess? How would any of these deals and potential changes affect you?
Oh, I'm absolutely watching it. I'm a pork producer. That's a large part of what we do. And, you know, depending on the figures that you hear, around 25% of our pork now is destined for export market. We can't eat all the pork we produce in this country. So you bet I'm watching it, as well as on the corn and soybean front.
And what do you want to see?
Oh, I want to see our successes built upon. I think NAFTA has been a huge win for agriculture, for one example. It's been a huge win, especially for the pork industry. Mexico's become our number one export destination for pork products. And we recognize that, you know, there's improvements, there's modernization that needs to take place. It's good to review agreements. But we want to see, in agriculture, we want to see our successes build upon. We certainly don't want to take a step back and be in a trade war situation.
Yeah. And what about the Farm Bill? What are you watching for there? I mean, that's another key piece of legislation that's coming up, like Peggy said.
Well, we still need to see that backstop for rural America from an economic standpoint. And I would say crop insurance is hugely important to farmers, as we see the calamity, the drought calamity of 2012. Now we've got floods and drought both hitting this year. And, you know, crop insurance works. When it's not needed, it doesn't pay, and yet it provides a very important backstop. So we're looking for that and some other economic backstops, some baseline floors of support in some of the prices will be very welcome.
Go ahead.
And I guess I'd like to add right now, we're also in a point on the last Farm Bill. The amount of government payment, the amount of government support to farmers has basically dried up. I mean, I'm not going to be receiving any payment or very little from last year's crop and probably very little from this year. So we're almost to the point that we don't have much government support other than crop insurance, which, you know, I still pay premiums for. So, you know, that's important to recognize.
You know, just coming back as we wrap up, we only got about a minute or so left here. But, Brian, you know, the agricultural economy, it's cyclical. You know, are you confident things will pick up going forward, or how are you feeling right now looking ahead?
Mixed. Cautious. I mean, as farmers, we're optimists, right? You know, we put that seed
to be,
in the
yeah.
ground. If we were pessimists, you know, my dad always says it's always darkest before it goes completely black. But that's not how I view things. You know, I'm optimistic. Every year we plant that seed, we hope for a good outcome. Livestock, we farrow a litter of pigs. You know, we think it's going to go great. I'm cautiously optimistic. We still have great demand for our products. We've got a hungry world to feed. So I'm hoping this is cyclical. Now, do I think that it's realistic that we will return to the highs of 2012 and 2013? I don't think so, barring some huge disaster from a weather standpoint, and no one wants to see that.
Right, right. Well, and, you know, Peggy, in about 10 seconds, what's the next moment to watch here? We're coming up on harvest season. What's sort of the next indicator that we should pay attention to?
The markets going into the fall, crop and soybean production, whether or not that drought continues up in North and South Dakota, especially for wheat, it's going to be dicey market-wise going into the fall and the harvest.
All right. Peggy Lowe, Investigations Editor, Harvest Public Media. Her story, Farm Economy Downturn Prompts Fears of a Crisis, inspired this conversation. Peggy, appreciate your time. Brian Duncan, a farmer in Ogle County up in northern Illinois, grows corn, also raises hogs and livestock, as you talked about there on that family farm. Both of you, thank you for your time today. I appreciate you coming on the 21st.
Thank you, Scott.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. You know, bad behavior from parents on the sidelines is nothing new, but we're learning more about its effect on the young players, on the coaches, on the referees. To drive the point home, one youth soccer league in South Carolina even recently created what they call a Silent September. Parents on the sidelines can't cheer, they can't jeer or shout. Just let them play, it says in the code of conduct form. What is all of this doing to sports, to kids? What can parents, coaches, and players do about it? In a moment, we'll hear from an organization in Chicago that's working with schools and leagues to change the dynamic at games. But first, I want to get one view from northeastern Illinois, Dylan Domke. He's a basketball referee, was a longtime youth baseball umpire. Dylan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be on the show.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I mean, you've officiated games, I understand, since you were young. I'm sure you have some stories, the good and the bad, but Is there a moment that stands out to you that just shows just how bad this can get sometimes at these games?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's been times where parents have come up to me in the parking lot or followed me out of gyms to tell me that, you know, they didn't agree with the call. And a lot of them, you know, they've been nice, but a good handful of them kind of get confrontational with you. And to
confrontational physical
someone,
or screaming, or how do you mean?
Just kind of yelling at you, raising their voice, just putting themselves in kind of a very aggressive position. You know, you could just tell based upon their body language that they're upset. And it hasn't happened to me, but I have had or have shared stories with other officials who have had parents get physical with them, whether it be shoving them, hitting them.
And these are kids' games. I mean, these are youth sports. And what does that do to you? I mean, do you carry that with you? What how does that affect you?
Well, it's not good. It definitely doesn't make you feel good as a person. I remember one of the basketball games that I was reffing this past season, at a South Suburban high school, and the coach just was relentless. And, you know, officials are humans. I'm not going to say that everyone's perfect, but we do a pretty darn good job at what we do, and we come prepared to the games. But this coach was over the top. Every call that was made was against him, and then we'd change it up, or, you know, and it just seemed like he had something to say about every call that was made that night.
And this was high school? This is a high school level, you said?
Correct.
Okay.
And you leave a game like that, and I mean, it was torment. I mean, I've never had anyone be so aggressive to an official, just in terms of how many arguments they were picking than this coach. And, you know, you just kind of leave feeling bad about yourself, just about everything. You know, you're questioning, you know, am I capable of doing this? And, you know, eventually a day later or so, you wake up and you're over it. And you look back and say, you know what? I'm a good ref. I know the rules. I've put my time in. I deserve to be there. But, you know, it stings for a little while, especially if they take it over the top. And, you know, sometimes they get personal with you, and that's always the worst.
Yeah, and in a game where it is supposed to be about fun, you know, we'll talk more about this too, but, I mean, the broader effect on the game, on the coaches, on referees, on the kids, I mean, it's pretty remarkable. Is there... training, I guess. Are you trained in some way to deal with some of these issues, or to ignore it maybe, or to resolve conflict in some way?
The officials do go through some training. It's not a bunch for conflict resolution. And, you know, you kind of just got to take it upon yourself to further that training that they give you in working with coaches and other individuals that are part of the game to make sure that it doesn't get taken a step too far.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that is letting the coach get their say, you know, give them an opportunity to tell you what they're thinking, as long as they're willing to talk. If they're going to come out and scream at the top of their lungs at you, then it's a whole different story. I don't know any officials, myself included, that aren't willing to have a conversation about a rule or a call and explain to you why the official called it at the appropriate time.
Yeah, in the appropriate way, too. You know, it's the voice of Dylan Domke, a basketball referee right now, has also done umpiring for youth baseball games. I do want to bring another voice here into this conversation, joined now by Ty Duncan. She's an executive director with the Positive Coaching Alliance. She's based in Chicago. That's a national nonprofit. Works with coaches, parents, athletes to create a more positive atmosphere around youth sports and some of the things we're talking about. Ty, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I mean, you're listening to this conversation here. I mean, kids, they play sports at least at first because it's fun, presumably, and then things happen like what Dylan's describing here, you know, and based on numbers I think I saw from your organization, that 7 in 10 kids quit by the time they're 13. What do you hear from players about why they're leaving sports and the effect of all this?
Yeah, that's an alarming stat, and it's one that we've seen through research, primarily through the National Association, the National Alliance for Youth Sports. And 70% of kids are dropping out of organized sports by the age of 13, and they're mostly reporting it's because the sports they're playing are not fun anymore. And so what we found is that part of the fun is that their coaches are taking things too seriously, focusing on the scoreboard and sort of entertainment culture around sports, or this demonstrative coaching, or thinking that you should treat kids a certain way that you really see more in the professional leagues. And we're seeing that sometimes parents can't quite stay in their lane. They're maybe living vicariously through their kids, or you know, screaming too much at games, doing too much interactive coaching when the kids are trying to play. And also teammates, you know, there's some degree of bullying that goes on. And so, you know, our organization is trying to create that development zone and get away from this sort of scoreboard-driven mentality, so that kids can develop and learn all the life lessons we know sports teach so well, and they won't learn those if they're not playing the game anymore.
Yeah, and I definitely want to talk more about sort of that. It sounds like more of an education type approach at this point. But you played college basketball, you coached, you've seen the stress, the competitiveness, down to the wire moments, you know, with pressure and everything. Looking back, I mean, can you recognize this a little bit from your own past? Was there a moment for you when you recognized that some of this was playing out in your own career?
Oh, absolutely. As an athlete and also as a coach, and I started playing multiple sports when I was in middle school, a bit late actually, starting at age 12. But my parents encouraged me to try different things. I was involved in theater and also in sports, and doing a lot of things that would sort of keep me learning and growing. And I think sports was a huge part of that, helping me to develop as a person with confidence and strength and fitness. And I didn't have any coaches growing up that were negative and that stopped me from wanting to play the game. And then as I got a little bit older, got into high school, same thing, you know, really strong teammate bonds and had a great experience. And then in college, you know, I faced a couple of different challenges with coaches that I had. I played volleyball as well. And so, you know, you have a variety of experiences, both positive and negative. But I found that when the stakes were higher at the college level, I still felt like that little, you know, 12-year-old kid. I still wanted to be encouraged, and I still wanted to feel like I was doing it because it was fun, even though the pressure was greater because I was playing at a higher level. And so I definitely felt that as an athlete when there were times where I still remember things coaches said to me that they probably felt were, you know, encouraging, or they probably felt were just stern to keep me motivated. But to me, they were really hurtful because it made me feel like I was not really adding value, that they were sort of tearing me down in a way that I took personally, but they probably didn't see it that way. I think nonverbal cues are a huge part of that. I think coaches don't always know. This is one thing I've grown as a coach, that, you know, when you roll your eyes, throw your hands up, mm-hmm. drop your clipboard, you know, turn your back on the kid, all of these are things that most of us have done as coaches without even realizing we're doing them. And kids always look to the coach and to their parents when they mess up and when they do something that's great. And if we can't reinforce positive behavior in both of those situations, then we're not doing kids a very good job for them. I mean, we're, yeah. you know, that's, as a coach now, I've been a coach for 8 years at high school girls basketball, and that's been a really important transition that I've had. I think when I first started coaching, I was always focused on helping girls become future great women. That was always important to me. That's what sports did for me. But I think when I first started, I was still very outcome-driven, and so I would get frustrated. Why can't you learn what I'm teaching? Why can't we win these games? Why was the score so close? Why did mm-hmm. we not win by more? All these, you know, sort of small things that were tearing away at me as a coach. And then I joined Positive Coaching Alliance 2 years ago, and a light bulb really did go off. It may sound, you know, a little cheesy as someone who's part of the organization, but as a coach myself, I started to see things differently, the nonverbals being a huge part of that, and really trying to model for my kids things like how to constantly try to get better at your craft, mastery of what you're doing, and also how to use mistakes to learn lessons and not just to create barriers in your development.
Yeah, going forward, the voice there of Ty Duncan, we're talking about sports and parents and sportsmanship and some of the stories that you often hear, you know, every summer, really, or throughout the year, I guess, in terms of some of the bad behavior you see on the sidelines. Also on the line, Dylan Domke, referee, longtime referee, an umpire in youth sports, about some of the experience that he's going seeing out there. Ty Duncan, just coming back to you for a minute, I mean, it seems like we're talking about two things right now. One is, you know, the behavior on the sidelines, you know, primarily from parents and perhaps from other players. And then where you're describing right now is creating that environment for the young athletes themselves, you know, in terms of what a coach can do and what their role is. In the kind of environment that we're describing with that intensity and that pressure and types of things, where, I guess, and if you can get kind of specific in terms of the program that you're operating, like, where do you begin to try to change the dynamic on the field? Do you also work with parents as part of the program?
We do, and we believe that it takes the entire youth sports ecosystem to actually affect change, the idea of culture change, defining how we do things here and making sure everyone's on the same page with that. So we provide workshop training for parents, coaches, student-athletes, athletic directors, and actually we also provide online training for officials. And so our whole goal is that everyone involved in youth sports will get the same messaging, that it's really about redefining success in a way, that success is not just the number on the scoreboard, although we do want kids to become skilled and to win. The goal should be, you know, to compete at a high level and to win, but that there's a longer-term objective, which is teaching life lessons, helping kids to develop character, and that has to come from all different angles.
You know, Dylan mentioned earlier the interaction that he had at one point with a coach. I was happy to talk. He's happy to have a conversation in the right way at the right time in the right moment. You know, one of the things that Positive Coaching Alliance does is they partner with schools and workshops and things you were describing. And I understand that there are workshops where people do sit down and they discuss and they kind of compare stories and in some ways hold each other accountable. Can you describe that? And what role does that play in kind of laying these out there and describing, you know, those moments when maybe we're not perfect and might be able to learn something from it?
Sure. So our structure is that we have certified trainers who, many of whom were coaches or athletes themselves and now have other day jobs that typically don't involve that, although some are still coaching. And they go out to our partners, which are primarily youth sports organizations and schools, and present workshops that are interactive. So they have a different curriculum for parents, coaches, student athletes, and athletic directors. But in each workshop, it's supposed to be interactive. There is the trainer will present questions and scenarios and ask that the members of the group share stories in small groups, share with the larger group, do certain acting out so that people can understand really the impact and how it looks to be positive versus negative or have nonverbal cues versus being really verbal and active. So the workshops are at the core of how we really teach the material, and we think of it as an ongoing partnership bigger than the 1 or 2 days you'll spend in a workshop. And so we hope that over time we can share resources. For example, we have books that our CEO Jim Thompson has written that give examples and have different questions and problem-solving opportunities for people to reflect back on it after the workshop as well as during. And we have an amazing resource that I encourage everyone to check out. It's called the Dev Zone, the Development Zone website. It's somewhat like a WebMD for youth sports, and the website link is devzone.positivecoach.org. That's a great resource. It's free for anyone to look to if they have questions or want to learn more about, you know, how to handle the car ride home after a loss or a win, you know, how to interact with your kid's coach. And we actually do have 26 resources online for officials. And
yeah, so a lot of tools
we try to interact in that way that everyone understands, as Dylan mentioned, that, you know, officials are human. I think part of what we learn is that people don't always see officials as human. They are, and we could do a better job, I think, between the referees, coaches, parents, and athletes of humanizing the official so that when the pressure is high, when there's a lot of emotion and intensity in the games on the line, that we're not seeing them as robots making calls that are, you know,
yeah,
obviously to destroy our opportunity. That's never what it is. They're doing the very best that they can.
Yeah. And Ty Duncan, and I don't mean to cut you off there, but just, I'm curious,
sure.
Dylan, I mean, we've only got about a minute left here, Dylan, but before we got to go to a break. But Dylan, I mean, how does this play out for you then? I mean, do you question being a ref? Do you think we're losing people? It's an important part of the game. We can't do this without referees and officials. Is it hurting the game from that perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt. You hear it in organizations every year when the beginning of the season comes up. Hey, guys, we need you to find younger officials, because just like everything and anything, officials age just as everyone else does. So people leave the profession and they leave the job. And if there's not people to fill those spots, then, you know, youth sports suffers, because a local baseball league or basketball league can't afford replay and this and that. So you need referees. And if there's people who don't want to do it because they don't feel safe or they feel like they're going to be tormented on the court, they're not going to do it. And
that's a loss to the community. It's a loss to the kids. It's a loss in so many different ways. It's Dylan Domke, Illinois basketball referee. I was an umpire and many other things. Dylan, I really appreciate your time today. Ty Duncan, please do stay with us. And we're going to pick up on this thread here in just a minute. We're going to talk with someone from the IHSA about referees and recruiting and how all of this is playing out across Illinois high school sports as well. But stay with us. I'm Scott Cameron, and this is The 21st. The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. We're talking today about parents and sports and some of the bad behavior that can happen on sidelines, and then some of the things that are out there to help prevent that, to help coaches and athletes and parents to create a better environment for the athletes who are really out there to have fun in the first place. Talking on the line here with Ty Duncan, Chapter Executive Director of Positive Coaching Alliance. She runs the Chicago office there, that group helping to do many things that we're talking about. I also want to bring in Kurt Gibson now. He's an Associate Executive Director of the IHSA, Illinois High School Association, and oversees boys basketball. Kurt, welcome to the show. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Always a pleasure.
So I should say welcome back. Yeah, we heard there from Dylan Domke a little bit about sort of the referees, and obviously youth sports don't work without coaches and referees in addition to the athletes and their parents. The last time you were on the show, you mentioned that Illinois has seen referee numbers drop. I think it was from about 15,000 down to about 12,000 across all the sports. Do you know how much of that has to do with just not wanting to confront some of this and to deal with this all the time, and is just out of frustration?
Unfortunately, we don't. When an official may drop off or discontinue their license, you know, there could be any number of reasons that they make that decision. And undoubtedly, the behaviors that they have to deal with would be one of the reasons. But certainly there would be the others why an official might, drop off the radar screen, so to speak.
Yeah. No, what does that mean then? If there is a shortage of referees, of umpires, of other officials out there, what does it mean for local leagues?
Well, I think as Dylan pointed out, you know, there are challenges in trying to, restock the officiating pool, if you will. I think there are a lot of things sort of going on right now. I'm not sure that the younger adult, the younger student, has totally grown up in the environment that the previous generation did, where they understand the importance of looking for ways to give back to their community. I think that's part of the challenge that officials groups have in trying to generate younger officials. I think sometimes what we hear is that younger officials want or expect to get big games right away, maybe before they're ready. And the thing that we try to really promote with our associations is let's try to get officials signed up. Let's give them a good experience. Let's provide them a mentor so that they can have someone by their side in those formative years as officials and work through some of the issues that all officials have to work through, including, you know, how to deal with unsporting behavior, whether it's from a coach, a player, or even a fan.
Yeah, Kurt, so what do you think? What is IHSA working on, or what are you seeing out there? What do you think needs to happen now to change the focus back to the positive? And I mean, to be fair, too, I think the negative instances get a lot of attention, but it's not the vast majority of what happens out there. But it does get a lot of attention. It does sort of skew some people's perceptions.
And, I would agree.
And change some people's decisions. So how do you redirect the focus? How do you get more people to look at the positive and realize the value of sports?
Well, I think you make a great point that these negative situations get the lion's share of attention, and the vast majority of players and coaches and fans have the right perspective, can go to a high school event or even a youth league event and behave themselves accordingly. The thing that we try to do with our membership is we really try to promote positive, good sportsmanship among student bodies. We've sort of taken the position that if we can get the student bodies conducting themselves in a positive fashion, that the adults will follow suit. You know, the adults will say, hey, looking over here at this cheering section of our students, they seem to not be too bent out of shape, that maybe the official called traveling or pass interference or called the ball out in volleyball. Maybe we need to have that same kind of perspective. We have a program right now. We've been doing this for about 3 years now called Do What's Right, where we try to encourage our student bodies to sign up, take sort of a sportsmanship pledge, and really commit to setting a positive tone within their school community, to be supportive of their classmates and not critical, negative towards their peers or towards their opponents. And it's really, really taken hold. So we've really tried to put the emphasis more on the folks that we want to try to shape and nurture so that when they become adults, maybe they've got a much better perspective than some adults have right now.
Yeah, I mean, Ty, that sounds like a great program. Ty, do you see this too? I mean, is good behavior often contagious on the sidelines?
I think that's right, because so often coach behavior toward officials, for example, signals to players and spectators how they should interact with the officials. I think with student-athletes, as we mentioned before, the ecosystem is really important. So if the athletic director believes that being positive is the way that we should proceed with our program, then the coaches believe that, and then the student-athletes believe that, and they want their parents on board with that. And so it is contagious, but it really requires that at least people in leadership, or especially the student-athletes who are part of being actually on the ground doing the sports, are engaged with this and believe in it.
And we've talked a lot now here about coaches and referees a little bit. I'd like to bring the conversation back to parents. I mean, that's how most people approach this from that perspective. You know, what do you think, and Ty Duncan, I'll turn to you on this one, what is the responsibility of the parent, not only to create the environment you're talking about, to make sure that the coaches and everybody else is on that field is also following through in that way and accountable?
So we have a couple of different models that we use, and one of them is the double goal coach, where the first goal is winning and the second more important goal is teaching life lessons. Well, our second goal parents are focused on that second goal, teaching life lessons. They're really more concerned with being a positive supporter, supporting not only their child but the other children on the team and on the field, being a good role model, and really trying to focus on the goal, the reason why we watch and play youth sports to begin with, which should be for kids to have fun, to develop, and to grow. And we hope winning comes along with that. So if the parents are refocused, I think, a little bit, it can be hard in the moment, especially if you played the sport or if you're really passionate about your kids and their success. Obviously, you're invested, you care about how your kids perform and their experience. It can be hard when you're in it to see the impact your behavior is having on your kid or others.
Yeah,
and so I think
moment.
If we just refocus and remember that it's that second goal, it's the life lessons and the character development, we'll see a lot fewer parents having challenging interactions with coaches, officials, and their kids as well.
Well, Ty, just as we wrap up here, we have been talking about the problem of, you know, bad behavior on the sidelines now. We've been talking about it for a long time, obviously, and not a problem that's, is it a problem that's too big to be solved, I guess, in some ways? Or do you see hope here from the work that you're doing and what we're hearing from this conversation that parents and coaches are getting the message?
There's hope. I think the schools that we partner with here and the youth sports organizations, they tell us that they have higher coach retention, that they have higher athlete retention, that when they focus on positivity, they just have better results for their sports programs. And I think parents are just supportive. They want to be there for their kids, and they can sometimes be a little bit off base when you think about how they show that support and that excitement for their kids and their success. But we know that positivity works better than negativity, and I'm hopeful that that does become contagious and that we do see that there's improved behavior from all different parts of this youth sports ecosystem, and that kids continue to play and they continue to get even more and more in the game with parents and coaches who support their development.
That's Ty Duncan, Chapter Executive Director of Positive Coaching Alliance, based there in Chicago. Also, Kurt Gibson, IHSA Associate Executive Director, oversees boys basketball there for the state. Thank you both. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. You know, an armadillo was spotted recently in Macon County near Decatur here in central Illinois. That's a bigger deal than it may sound. It's the farthest north in the state the Illinois Department of Natural Resources has ever seen an armadillo. Why does this matter, and what should you do if you spot one? Joining me now to get some answers to all these questions is Bob Blewett. He's a biologist at the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. Bob, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
So why does an armadillo in central Illinois raise red flags?
Well, we've seen expansion of the armadillo's range well in the United States since the 1800s, 1850s, when they first reached Texas from South America, and they've marched northwards ever since.
So they're not native to Illinois. They're not.
No, they are not. They're native to South America.
So, what other parts of Illinois have we seen armadillos at this point?
Well, there was a biologist at Illinois Natural History Survey named Joyce Hoffman who took an interest in the species and kind of compiled observations of armadillos from 1990 through 2008. And she told up 166 what she considered solid records of the species in the mm-hmm. state. Most of those were in southern Illinois, probably south of a line that would follow roughly I-70. And in recent years, we've had far more documented cases of armadillos in the state. And kind of in the last just couple of years, maybe 3 years, we've seen a fairly good rash of sightings in between I-70 and I-72, which would be north of what Joyce considered their limit in the state. Because
of temperature, because of, well, I mean, correct. You tell me what's...
Because of temperature, they don't hibernate. So they need to sustain themselves all year long, which is hard for an animal that eats insects in central Illinois winters, especially when we have, you know, cold spells and deep snow. That's yeah. very tough on them. They rely a lot on their burrows to thermoregulate, and which would include both during the summer when it's really hot and they're subject to dehydration, and during the winter, of course, when the temperatures are cold.
So those warming temperatures we're starting to see Illinois. There's a warming trend that's been going on. We're seeing this in agriculture in some ways, and now in this case, which is why sort of the armadillo is, you know, a sign of something more. And what's the risk then of armadillos coming in? I mean, you know, some people look at them, they might be listening, say, oh, armadillos, they're cute. I see them wander around, that'd be kind of neat. But what does that do to Illinois, to in places where it doesn't normally belong?
Well, I think for the environment in general, it's not a big change for Illinois. We've seen a lot of changes in the types of plants and animals that, you know, are in the state over the last couple of hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that's such a big thing. But
they have
of course,
predators here in Illinois? I mean, are there, you know, we hear a lot about Asian
maybe.
Carp and things, that that's a big serious problem. Is this sort of on a line with an Asian carp or not so much?
Hard to say at this point. Kind of keeping tabs on things. They're grow up to about 22 pounds, so probably the only predators we have in the state that would pose a threat to them would be things like coyotes or bobcats or domestic dogs or mm-hmm. vehicles, which is where a lot of our records
yeah.
come from.
Yeah, sadly. What do armadillos eat? Do they compete with native wildlife in some form? Do they?
They're primarily insectivores. They eat things like ants and termites, worms, earthworms, and grubs, beetle grubs that are in the ground, which is where a lot of times they come into conflicts with people because they like to eat grubs and earthworms. They'll get into your lawn, and if you can imagine a 22-pound mole, it can cause a lot of damage in a short amount of time.
Yeah, and are there health concerns too? I mean, if people see one, you mentioned sort of on the side of the road or whatnot, are these animals that you should be trying to touch, or are there health issues?
Probably not. They are capable of carrying leprosy. The prevalence varies in different parts of their range, and we really don't have an idea for Illinois yet. So if you're going to touch one, I'd recommend doing it with gloves or washing your hands afterward.
And so if you
spot
one,
we don't know for sure.
Stay away. Call you guys, I guess. Call the professionals, huh?
Well, we'd like to get records of animals, particularly in the northern part of their range, which I would consider at this time somewhere between I-70 and I-72 or farther north. We've had a few records as far north as Will County. Those records that are really far out there are kind of hard to interpret. Did somebody pick one up and
The outliers
stink in their trunk and they tossed it off on the side of the road or, mm-hmm. or what was going on there. But I think from the number of sightings we've had in the past 2-3 years in central Illinois, certainly, we would be interested in documenting those either through a phone call or people can go onto our website, Living with Wildlife in Illinois, and there's a section there where you can report unusual animal sightings, and they ask for a location and the date.
Okay, and we can tweet all of that out. But Bob Blewett, I'm sorry, we're just out of time, but we'll put it out on social media. Bob Blewett, biologist at the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have here today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. Also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, easy to find there. Just tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st, if you have that enabled. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us by phone, email, social media, that's all at our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter, search for The 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis, background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us there. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want to ask us on air. I'm Scott Cameron. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.